Rikers Island is the nation's largest jail, a place that houses prisoners who are awaiting trial and where convicted offenders serve sentences of 1 year or less. This year, an estimated 7,000 young people at the cusp of adulthood will go there, teenagers between 16 and 18 years old. The overwhelming majority of them will likely return within a year of release. Those young men and women who leave Rikers Island for good can trace some connection to the Friends of Island Academy, a nonprofit agency that gives them counseling and job training. Several ex-offenders and former residents who've been helped by the Friends of Island Academy recently made a series of documentaries called Youth Portraits, capturing their lives on audio tape. This week we have a story from 23-year-old Ariel Corcoran, who goes by the nickname A-Son.
A-Son is like my alter ego, I guess. This is this person who's cool with everybody in the streets, and everybody in the streets knows him. I always felt like my family wasn't my family. I always felt like the outcast. I was always different. As a little kid, I wouldn't want to come home. I would go to school. After school, I'd go to a park. Instead of taking a bus, I'd walk home. And it'll take me hours and hours to get home. And I loved it. As far back as I can remember, I never felt close to my family. My dad left right after I was born, and my mom and I never understood each other. We're opposites in every way. She's very strict. I've always been more of a dreamer. She's probably the most serious person I know.
Where's your questions?
Describe me as a kid.
I have to answer this? When you were little, you were a good kid. You were quiet, and you did as you were told. I used to like to dress you up like a little man and show you off.
I grew up in a rough neighborhood. My mom wanted to keep me out of trouble, so she made me stay in the house all the time. She was trying to protect me, but I felt trapped. Things got real bad when she married my stepfather. I was 7.
At that time, it wasn't easy to find someone who was willing to take on all of that responsibility for somebody else's child.
Did you guys discuss, like, the rules, regulations, or boundaries that, you know, he would have to, like, follow, you know, being a stepfather?
No.
No, he had, like, total freedom.
No, he was your father. Your father wasn't around.
When my stepfather moved in, I became a prisoner in my own house. At first, I escaped into a fantasy world. I'd play hand puppet games or lock myself in a bathroom and race cockroaches up the wall. But I got older. The more he kept me in, the more I wanted to leave. If I managed to escape, there were consequences.
His discipline got a little out of hand.
Exactly. That's what I want to know. Did you guys ever talk about that?
What are you talking about? What do you mean, did we talk? What did we talk about?
Like, don't hit my kid so bad or something. Did you ever say nothing?
There was one time when he beat you up very badly in the bathtub, and I talked to him because he got out of hand. But there's no list of rules and regulations. There's no, oh, hands off, that's my child, you can't touch him.
But didn't you think that was harming me in any way?
That time when he beat you up like that, yes.
Oh,
he was disciplining you and punishing you, and he was doing it for me. There were times when I felt that he was overly strict, but he was doing a job. He was doing the job of a father.
Did it work?
Obviously not.
I started to rebel. At home, I was a nobody. I was alone and I was weak. Outside of the house, I created a different me. After my freshman year of high school, I got locked up for smacking some kid and taking his book bag. I didn't even like the book bag. I just took it to be a badass. I was in Lincoln Hall. It's a juvenile facility called Lincoln Hall in Lincolndale, New York. I learned from all these other juvenile delinquents how to be a delinquent, how to be a criminal, how to be a thug, how to be a drug dealer. By the time I got out of there, I knew everything I needed to know about drugs. Where to get them, where to push them, how to push them, where to stash them. When I got back from juvenile detention, I started hustling. I was 17. I was in a school, in a high school called Truman High School, and I met this guy there in the cafeteria. His name was Harold. He told me to call him Biggs. He was a drug dealer. If you would have seen the roll of money this guy pulled out, you would have, like, melted. So, of course, I asked him about it. I was, you know, how can I get down? How can I get that kind of money? And he said, you know, you could come work for me. Now, we could make this money together. You could come to my block instead of going to school, and you could sell crack. You know how to sell crack. And I played it off like, yeah, I've hustled before, you know. I didn't know nothing about the business. But I knew that I was determined to learn, and I was determined to be part of this inner circle, this forbidden family. I just started hustling first day there. He was out there with me to let me know who the customers were. You know, like, yeah, sell to him, don't sell to him. Sell to him, don't sell to him. And I was getting pretty full. I was doing it good. Like, the bundle was gone in less than an hour. That night, I came home with, like, about $80. And that was, like, my first time hustling. And I was like, wow, I'm a drug dealer now. I would leave my house at 7:30 in the morning to go to school, supposedly. I'd be at the spot by 9. I was the hand-to-hand guy. I did the hand-to-hand sales, and I sold $3 bags, $5 bags, and somebody next to me sold a $10 bags of dope. After a few weeks, I got made a manager. For a person like Biggs to give me authority, give me respect to say, okay, I think you can handle this business right here, and for me to make money out of that, and for me to meet people that think that I'm cool, that was hot. I needed that. How many times my mother told me I ain't gonna be shit. And I told her, you know, I'm just leaving, you know. So I did it. I moved out. By the end of the night, I had a room. By the end of the week, I had a whole apartment at the age of 17. My first employee was a guy named Kareem. He went by the name of Knowledge. Nalo and I became real tight. He was older than me, and I looked up to him. He had like a funny beard. He had like a goat. It wasn't a goatee, because his mustache and his beard didn't connect yet. But his beard was, like, pointy, and he had a funny mustache. And, you know, he had those eyes. His eyes was real. Like, he could see right through you. He was 21 years old. He just came out of doing a five-year stretch, so he was real gangstified, and he acted that way. So Knowledge started coming to my house every morning. I go under the mattress or under the rug where I had the crack stash, pull out, like, 3-4 bundles, give them two. And keep one on me. And I'd stay in front of the stoop, talking to him a little bit until he starts getting customers. When customers start coming on the block, I'd send him around the corner. I'd stay in front of the building where I'm away from the crack and away from the crack dealing. And I'd just sit there. I was tall. I had a nice little chain then. You know, people started to recognize me. I looked different. I was a different face on the block. They knew I was different there. They knew I had to be the hustler. I had it all. It was like a dream. I felt invincible. Here it is, October 15th, 1997. The year's almost over. I haven't been to school in a little while. And I'm almost out of crack. Me and Knowledge are just kicking the breeze. And we sold a couple of slabs that were left when this guy comes up to us. And he's like, where's the crack out here? He was short and stocky, and he was kind of well built for a crackhead. He was clean cut, which is not the norm. I looked at Knowledge, and Knowledge already knew. He was like, no, I don't sell crack. Go down the block. The dude was like, nah, y'all don't sell crack? Let me get two slabs. I know you got slabs. Now, we call crack slabs. Crackheads come, let me get a hit, let me get two hits. They don't say slabs. We say slabs. And Knowledge was telling the guy, look, we don't sell crack, man. This guy was insisting too, like, you know, I know you sell crack, come on, just give me my two slabs, even though we told him no like 3,000 times. And Knowledge is like, look, man, I don't sell crack, get off my block, talking all that nonsense. The guy sits down on the stoop a couple of feet away from us. So I moved over a little bit, and I saw them arguing, and they go at it, and the dude is on Knowledge, and Knowledge got him in a full Nelson, and he's trying to reach for his gun. So when he went to reach for his gun, I reached for his gun too. I reached for his hand. His hand clutched the gun. He was pulling it out. When I seen him pulling it out, I pushed it in. I think when I pushed it in, that's when it went off. When that gunshot went off, in a blink of a second, a whole bunch of other cops started shooting at us out of nowhere. Two vans pulled up a car, and a fat guy with a gun that was right there on the corner shooting at me. I mean, right in front of me, shooting directly at me. I saw the smoke coming out that barrel. I saw the gun. I just saw the gun. I saw the holes of the revolver around the barrel. I saw his hand clutching the trigger. I saw his white fingers. It seemed like something out of Bruce Willis movie. He was just running at me, shooting at me. And I got shot in my leg. It felt cold. And then I felt my hot blood on my skin. which was getting numb. Then I got shot again. And I kept my hands up. Like, I'm hit. You shot me. I'm shot. So some cop comes up to me, puts handcuffs on me, and drags me to the corner. And they were still shooting. They were shooting at Knowledge. When I turned around, I saw Knowledge, and Knowledge was bleeding out his neck. And Kareem looked up at me, and he was crying. He said he can't breathe. I said, son, I can't breathe, son, I can't breathe. I ain't gonna make it. He was dying. He was dying, and he was telling me that he was dying. "172 shells were recovered. No weapons or drugs were found, and I was sent to jail anyway. My lawyer told me to plead guilty to armed robbery and assault to avoid trial. When I came home from Rikers, I lost the apartment I was living in, my clothes were in bags, and I had no money. But it didn't matter anymore. The incident had changed me. This tough drug-dealing character I created for myself died the minute Knowledge did. I was ready to just be me, even with my mom. My stepfather was not around anymore, but my mom was just as hard on me now as she ever was, especially about the incident.
It would upset me tremendously to hear you talk about it as if it was somebody else's fault. Yes, they shot at you from behind, but you were not supposed to be there.
Do you feel lucky?
You should feel lucky that you're alive.
I have 3 jobs now. I have a girlfriend I'm about to marry and a beautiful 7-month-old baby boy. And me and my mom, we'll keep working on it.
I gotta go to sleep.
I still gotta ask you more questions.
Well, I gotta go to sleep. Sorry, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I gotta go to sleep.
All right, can we finish this some other day?
Some other day. I gotta go to sleep.
Cool.
Ariel Corpin lives with his girlfriend, Leilani, and their son, Dejon, in Brooklyn. He now works as an outreach coordinator on Rikers Island for Friends of Island Academy. Mr. Corcoran's story was produced by Stacey Abramson and Sound Portraits Productions. To hear other youth portraits from this series, visit our website at npr.org.